to his shoulder and set out after them. A dog in the shade of the portal rose and lurched sullenly out into the sun until he had passed, and then lurched back. He took the road down the hill toward the river, a ragged figure enough. He entered a deep wood of pecan and oak, and the road took a rise, and he could see the river below him. Blacks were washing a carriage in the ford, and he went down the hill and stood at the edge of the water, and after a while he called out to them. They were sopping water over the black lacquerwork, and one of them raised up and turned to look at him. The horses stood to their knees in the current.
"What?"
called the black.
"Have you seen a mule?"
"Mule?"
"I lost a mule. I think he come this way."
The black wiped his face with the back of his arm.
"Something come down the road about an hour back. I think it went down the river yonder. It might have been a mule. It didn't have no tail, nor no hair to speak of, but it did have long ears."
The other two blacks grinned. The kid looked off down the river. He spat and set off along the path through the willows and swales of grass. He found it about 100 yards downriver. It was wet to its belly, and it looked up at him and then lowered its head again into the lush river grass. He threw down the saddle and took up the trailing rope and tied the animal to a limb and kicked it half-heartedly. It shifted slightly to the side and continued to graze. He reached atop his head, but he had lost the crazy hat somewhere. He made his way down through the trees and stood looking at the cold, swirling waters. Then he waded out into the river, like some holy, wretched baptismal candidate. Chapter 3. Sought out to join an army. Interview with Captain White. His views. The camp. Trades his mule. A cantina in the Laredito. A Mennonite. Companion killed. He was lying naked under the trees, with his rags spread across the limbs above him, when another rider, going down the river, reined up and stopped. He turned his head. Through the willows he could see the legs of the horse. He rolled over on his stomach. The man got down and stood beside the horse. He reached and got his twine-handled knife.
"Howdy there," said the rider.
He didn't answer. He moved to the side to see better through the branches.
"Howdy there. Where you at?"
"What do you want?"
"Wanted to talk to you."
"What about?"
"Well, fire, come on out. I'm White and Christian."
The kid was reaching up through the willows trying to get his breeches. The belt was hanging down, and he tugged at it, but the breeches were hung on a limb.
"Goddamn," said the man. "You ain't up in the tree, are you?"
"Why don't you go on and leave me the hell alone?"
"Just wanted to talk to you. Didn't intend to get you all riled up."
"You done got me riled."
"Was you the fella knocked in that Mexer's head yesterday evening? I ain't the law."
"Who wants to know?"
"Captain White. He wants to sign that feller up to join the army."
"The army?"
"Yes, sir."
"What army?"
"Company under Captain White. We going to whip up on the Mexicans."
"The war's over."
"He says it ain't over." "Where are you at?"
He rose and hauled the breeches down from where he'd hung them and pulled them on. He pulled on his boots and put the knife in the right boot leg and came out from the willows pulling on his shirt. The man was sitting in the grass with his legs crossed. He was dressed in buckskin, and he wore a plug hat of dusty black silk, and he had a small Mexican cigar in the corner of his teeth. When he saw what clawed its way out through the willows, he shook his head.
"Kindly fell on hard times, ain't you, son?"
he said.
"I just ain't fell on no good ones." You ready to go to Mexico? I ain't lost nothing down there. It's a chance for you to raise yourself in the world. You best make a move some way or another before you go plumb in under. What do they give you? Every man gets a horse and his ammunition. I reckon we might find some clothes in your case. I ain't got no rifle. We'll find you one. What about wages? Hell, fire, son, you won't need no wages. You get to keep everything you can raise. We going to Mexico. Spoils of war. And a man in the company won't come out a big landowner. How much land you own now? I don't know nothing about soldiering. The man eyed him. He took the unlit cigar from his teeth and turned his head and spat and put it back again. Where you from? He said.
Tennessee.
Tennessee? Well, I don't misdoubt but what you can shoot a rifle. The kid squatted in the grass. He looked at the man's horse. The horse was fitted out in tooled leather with worked silver trim. It had a white blaze on its face and four white stockings, and it was cropping up great teethfuls of the rich grass.
"Where you from?" said the kid.
"I've been in Texas since 38. If I had not run up on Captain White, I don't know where I'd be this day. I was a sorrier sight even than what you are, and he come along and raised me up like Lazarus, set my feet in the path of righteousness. I done took to drinking and whoring till hell wouldn't have me. He seen something in me worth saving, and I see it in you. What do you say?"
"I don't know."
"Just come with me and meet the captain."
The boy pulled at the homs of grass. He looked at the horse again.
"Well," he said, "don't reckon it'd hurt nothing."
They rode through the town with the recruiter Splendid on the stocking-footed horse and the kid behind him on the mule like something he'd captured. They rode through narrow lanes where the wattled huts steamed in the heat. Grass and prickly pear grew on the roofs, and goats walked about on them, and somewhere off in that squalid kingdom of mud the sound of the little death bells tolled thinly. They turned up Commerce Street through the main plaza among rafts of wagons, and they crossed another plaza where boys were selling grapes and figs from little trundle carts. A few bony dogs slank off before them. They rode through the military plaza, and they passed the little street where the boy and the mule had drunk the night before, and there were clusters of women and girls at the well, and many shapes of wicker-covered clay jars standing about. They passed a little house where women inside were wailing, and the little hearse cart stood at the door with the horses patient and motionless in the heat and the flies. The captain kept quarters in a hotel on a plaza where there were trees and a small green gazebo with benches. An iron gate at the hotel front opened into a passageway with a courtyard at the rear. The walls were whitewashed and set with little ornate colored tiles. The captain's man wore carved boots with tall heels that rang smartly on the tiles and on the stairs ascending from the courtyard to the rooms above. In the courtyard there were green plants growing, and they were freshly watered and steaming. The captain's man strode down the long balcony and rapped sharply at the door at the end. A voice said for them to come in. He sat at a wickerwork desk writing letters, the captain. They stood attending, the captain's man with his black hat in his hands. The captain rode on, nor did he look up. Outside, the kid could hear a woman speaking in Spanish. Other than that, there was just the scratching of the captain's pen. When he had done, he laid down the pen and looked up. He looked at his man, and then he looked at the kid, and then he bent his head to read what he'd written. He nodded to himself and dusted the letter with sand from a little onyx box and folded it. Taking a match from a box of them on the desk, he lit it and held it to a stick of sealing wax until a small red medallion had pooled onto the paper. He shook out the match, blew briefly at the paper, and knuckled the seal with his ring. Then he stood the letter between two books on his desk and leaned back in his chair and looked at the kid again. He nodded gravely.
"Take seats," he said.
They eased themselves into a kind of settle made from some dark wood. The captain's man had a large revolver at his belt, and as he sat, he hitched the belt around so that the piece lay cradled between his thighs. He put his hat over it and leaned back. The kid folded his busted boots one behind the other and sat upright. The captain pushed his chair back and rose and came around to the front of the desk. He stood there for a measured minute, and then he hitched himself up on the desk and sat with his boots dangling. He had gray in his hair and in the sweeping mustaches that he wore, but he wasn't old.
"So you're the man," he said.
"What man?" said the kid. "What man, sir?" said the captain's man.
"How old are you, son?"
19. The captain nodded his head. He was looking the kid over.
"What happened to you?"
"What?"
"Say, sir," said the recruiter.
"Sir?"
"I said, what happened to you?"
The kid looked at the man sitting next to him. He looked down at himself, and he looked at the captain again. "I was fell on by robbers," he said.
"Robbers," said the captain.
"Took everything I had. Took my watch and everything."
"Have you got a rifle?"
"Not no more, I ain't."
"Where was it you were robbed?"
"I don't know. There wasn't no name to it. It was just a wilderness."
"Where were you coming from?"
"I was coming from Nacogdoches? "Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir."
"How many were there?"
The kid stared at him.
"Robbers. How many robbers?"
7 or 8, I reckon. I got busted in the head with a scantling." The captain squinted one eye at him.
"Were they Mexicans?"
"Some. Mexicans and niggers. There was a white or two with them. They had a bunch of cattle they'd stole. Only thing they left me with was an old piece of knife I had in my boot."
The captain nodded. He folded his hands between his knees. "What do you think of the treaty?" he said.
The kid looked at the man on the settle next to him. He had his eyes shut. He looked down at his thumbs. "I don't know nothing about it," he said.
"I'm afraid that's the case with a lot of Americans," said the captain. "Where are you from, son?"
"Tennessee."
"You weren't with the volunteers at Monterey, were you?"
"No, sir."
"Bravest bunch of men under fire I believe I ever saw. I suppose more men from Tennessee bled and died on the field in northern Mexico than from any other state. Did you know that?"
"No, sir."
"They was sold out. Fought and died down there in that desert. And then they were sold out by their own country."
The kid sat silent. The captain leaned forward.
"We fought for it. Lost friends and brothers down there. And then, by God, if we didn't give it back. Back to a bunch of barbarians that even the most biased in their favor will admit have no least notion in God's earth of honor or justice or the meaning of republican government. A people so cowardly they've paid tribute 100 years to tribes of naked savages. Given up their crops and livestock, mines shut down, whole villages abandoned, while a heathen horde rides over the land looting and killing with total impunity. Not a hand raised against them. What kind of people are these? The Apaches won't even shoot them. Did you know that? They kill them with rocks."
The captain shook his head. He seemed made sad by what he had to tell.
Did you know that when Colonel Doniphan took Chihuahua City, he inflicted over 1,000 casualties on the enemy and lost only one man, and him all but a suicide? With an army of unpaid irregulars that called him Bill, were half-naked, and had walked to the battlefield from Missouri? No, sir.
The captain leaned back and folded his arms.
What we are dealing with, he said, is a race of degenerates. A mongrel race, little better than niggers, and maybe no better. There is no government in Mexico. Hell, there's no God in Mexico. Never will be. We are dealing with a people manifestly incapable of governing themselves. And you know what happens with people who cannot govern themselves? That's right. Others come in to govern for them. There are already some 14,000 French colonists in the state of Sonora. They're being given free land to settle. They're being given tools and livestock. Enlightened Mexicans encourage this. Paredes is already calling for secession from the Mexican government. They'd rather be ruled by toad-eaters than thieves and imbeciles. Colonel Carrasco is asking for American intervention, and he's going to get it. Right now, they're forming in Washington a commission to come out here and draw up the boundary lines between our country and Mexico. I don't think there's any question that ultimately Sonora will become a United States territory. Guayama's a U.S. port. Americans will be able to get to California without having to pass through our benighted sister republic, and our citizens will be protected at last from the notorious packs of cutthroats presently infesting the routes which they are obliged to travel. The captain was watching the kid. The kid looked uneasy. Son, said the captain, we are to be the instruments of liberation in a dark and troubled land. That's right. We are to spearhead the drive. We have the tacit support of Governor Burnett of California. He leaned forward and placed his hands on his knees. And we will be the ones who will divide the spoils. There will be a section of land for every man in my company. Fine grassland. Some of the finest in the world. A land rich in minerals, in gold and silver, I would say, beyond the wildest speculation. You're young, but I don't misread you. I'm seldom mistaken in a man. I think you mean to make your mark in this world. Am I wrong?
No, sir.
No. And I don't think you're the sort of chap to abandon a land that Americans fought and died for to a foreign power. And mark my word, unless Americans act, people like you and me who take their country seriously, while those mollycoddles in Washington sit on their hindsides, unless we act, Mexico, and I mean the whole of the country, will one day fly a European flag, Monroe Doctrine or no.
The captain's voice had become soft and intense. He tilted his head to one side and regarded the kid with a sort of benevolence. The kid rubbed the palms of his hands on the knees of his filthy jeans. He glanced at the man beside him, but he seemed to be asleep.
"What about a saddle?" he said.
"Saddle?"
"Yes, sir."
"You don't have a saddle?"
"No, sir."
"I thought you had a horse."
"A mule."
"I see."
"I got an old hull on the mule, but there ain't much left of it. Ain't a whole lot left of the mule. He said I was to get a horse and a rifle."
"Sergeant Trammell did?" "I never promised him no saddle," said the sergeant. "We'll get you a saddle." "I did tell him we might find him some clothes, Captain." "Right. We may be irregulars, but we don't want to look like bobtails, do we?"
"No, sir." "We ain't got no more broke horses, neither," said the sergeant.
"Well, break one."
"That old boy that was so good about breaking them is out of commission."
"I know that. Get somebody else."
"Yes, sir."
"Maybe this man can break horses. You ever break horses?"
"No, sir."
"Ain't no need to sir me."
"Yes, sir."
"Sergeant," said the captain, easing himself down from the desk.
Yes, sir?
Sign this man up. The camp was upriver at the edge of the town. A tent patched up from old wagon canvas, a few wickiups made of brush, and beyond them a corral in the form of a figure eight, likewise made from brush, where a few small painted ponies stood sulking in the sun.
Corporal,
called the sergeant.
He ain't here.
He dismounted and strode toward the tent and threw back the fly. The kid sat on the mule. Three men were lying in the shade of a tree, and they studied him.
Howdy,
said one.
Howdy.
You new man?
I reckon.
Captain say when we're leaving this pest hole?
He never said.
The sergeant came from the tent.
Where's he at? He said.
Gone to town.
Gone to town, said the sergeant.
Come here. The man rose from the ground and ambled over to the tent and stood with his hands resting in the small of his back.
This here man ain't got no outfit, said the sergeant.
The man nodded. The captain gave him a shirt and some money to get his boots mended. We need to get him something he can ride, and we need to get him a saddle.
A saddle?
Ought to be able to sell that mule for enough to get him one of some kind. The man looked at the mule and turned back and squinted at the sergeant. He leaned and spat.
Get their mule won't bring $10.
What it brings, it brings.
They done killed another beef.
I don't want to hear about it.
I can't do nothing with them.
I ain't telling the captain. He'll roll them eyes around till they come unscrewed and fall out in the ground.
The man spat again.
Well, that's the God's truth anyway.
See to this man now. I got to get.
Well,
ain't nobody sick, is they?
No.
Thank God for that.
He stood up into the saddle and touched the horse's neck lightly with the reins. He looked back and shook his head. In the evening, the kid and two other recruits went into town. He'd bathed and shaved himself, and he wore a pair of blue cord trousers and the cotton shirt the captain had given him, and save for the boots, he looked a new man altogether. His friends rode small and colorful horses that 40 days ago had been wild animals on the plain, and they shied and skittered and snapped like turtles.
"Where'll you get you one of these?"
said the second corporal.
"You ain't never had no fun."
"These horses is all right," said the other. "There's one or two in there yet that might make ye a horse."
The kid looked down at them from his mule. They rode either side like escorts, and the mule trotted with its head up, its eyes shifting nervously.
"They'll all stick ye head in the ground," said the second corporal.
They rode through a plaza thronged with wagons and stock, with immigrants and Texans and Mexicans, and with slaves and Lipan Indians, and deputations of Karankawas, tall and austere, their faces dyed blue, and their hands locked about the shafts of their 6-foot spears, all but naked savages who, with their painted skins and their whispered taste for human flesh, seemed outrageous presences even in that fabled company. The recruits rode with their animals close-reined, and they turned up past the courthouse and along the high walls of the carcel with the broken glass embedded in the topmost course. In the main plaza, a band had assembled and were at tuning their instruments. The riders turned down Salina Street past small gaming houses and coffee stands, and there were in this street a number of Mexican harness makers and traders and keepers of game chickens and cobblers and bootmakers in little stalls or shops of mud. The second corporal was from Texas and spoke a little Spanish, and he meant to trade the mule. The other boy was from Missouri. They were in good spirits, scrubbed and combed, clean shirts all, each foreseeing a night of drink, perhaps of love. How many youths have come home cold and dead from just such nights and just such plans? They traded the mule, accoutred as it was, for a Texas stock saddle, bare tree with rawhide cover, not new, but sound. For a bridle and bit that was new. For a woven wool blanket from Saltillo that was dusty, new or not. And lastly, for a $2.50 gold piece. The Texan looked at this small coin in the kid's palm and demanded more money, but the harness maker shook his head and held up his hands in utter finality.
"What about my boots?" said the kid.
"Isus botas," said the Texan.
"Botas?
Si."
He made sewing motions. The harness maker looked down at the boots. He cupped his fingers in a little gesture of impatience, and the kid took off the boots and stood barefoot in the dust. When all was done, they stood in the street and looked at one another. The kid had his new tack slung up on his shoulder. The second corporal looked at the boy from Missouri.
"You got any money, Earl?"
"Not a copper cent."
"Well, I ain't either. We might as well get our asses back on out to that hole of misery."
The kid shifted the weight of the gear on his shoulder.
"We got this quarter eagle to drink up yet," he said.
Already it is twilight down in the Laredito. Bats fly forth from their roostings in courthouse and tower and circle the quarter. The air is full of the smell of burning charcoal. Children and dogs squat by the mud stoops, and gamecocks flap and settle in the branches of the fruit trees. They go afoot, these comrades, down along a bare adobe wall. Band music carries dimly from the square. They pass a water cart in the street, and they pass a hole in the wall where by the light of a small forge fire an old man beats out shapes of metal. They pass in a doorway a young girl whose beauty becomes the flowers about. They arrive at last before a wooden door. It's hinged into a larger door or gate, and all must step over the foot-high sill where 1,000 boots have scuffed away the wood, where fools in their hundreds have tripped or fallen or tottered drunkenly into the street. They pass along a ramada in a courtyard by an old grape arbor, where small fowl nod in the dusk among the gnarled and barren vines, and they enter a cantina where the lamps are lit, and they cross stooping under a low beam to a bar and belly up 1, 2, 3. There is an old disordered Mennonite in this place, and he turns to study them. A thin man in a leather waistcoat, a black and straight-brim hat set square on his head, a thin rim of whiskers. The recruits order glasses of whiskey and drink them down, and order more. There are monte games at tables by the wall, and there are whores at another table who look the recruits over. The recruits stand sideways along the bar with their thumbs in their belts and watch the room. They talk among themselves of the expedition in loud voices, and the old Mennonite shakes a rueful head and sips his drink and mutters.
"They'll stop you at the river," he says.
The second corporal looks past his comrades.
"Are you talking to me?"
"At the river, be told. They'll jail you to a man."
"Who will?"
"The United States Army, General Worth."
"The hell they will."
"Pray that they will."
He looks at his comrades. He leans toward the Mennonite.
"What does that mean, old man?"
"Do ye cross that river with yon filibuster armed, ye'll not cross it back."
"Don't aim to cross it back. We go on to Sonora." "What's it to you, old man?"
The Mennonite watches the enshadowed dark before them as it is reflected to him in the mirror over the bar. He turns to them. His eyes are wet. He speaks slowly.
"The wrath of God lies sleeping. It was here a million years before men were, and only men have power to wake it. Hell ain't half full. Hear me. Ye carry war of a madman's making into a foreign land. Ye'll wake more than the dogs.
But they berated the old man and swore at him until he moved off down the bar, muttering. And how else could it be? How these things end, in confusion and curses and blood. They drank on, and the wind blew in the streets, and the stars that had been overhead lay low in the west. And these young men fell afoul of others, and words were said that could not be put right again. And in the dawn the kid and the second corporal knelt over the boy from Missouri who had been named Earl, and they spoke his name, but he never spoke back. He lay on his side in the dust of the courtyard. The men were gone. The whores were gone. An old man swept the clay floor within the cantina. The boy lay with his skull broken in a pool of blood, none knew by whom. A third one came to be with them in the courtyard. It was the Mennonite. A warm wind was blowing, and the east held a gray light. The fowls, roosting among the grapevines, had begun to stir and call. "There is no such joy in the tavern as upon the road thereto," said the Mennonite. He had been holding his hat in his hands, and now he set it upon his head again, and turned, and went out the gate. Chapter 4. Setting forth with the filibusters, on alien ground, shooting antelope, pursued by cholera, wolves, wagon repairs, a desert waste, night storms, the ghost manada, a prayer for rain, a desert homestead, the old man, new country, an abandoned village, herdsmen on the plain, attacked by Comanches. 5 days later, on the dead man's horse, he followed the riders and wagons through the plaza and out of the town on the road down country. They rode through Castroville, where coyotes had dug up the dead and scattered their bones. And they crossed the Frio River, and they crossed the Nueces, and they left the Presidio Road and turned north with scouts posted ahead and to the rear. They crossed the Del Norte by night and waded up out of the shallow sandy ford into a howling wilderness. Dawn saw them deployed in a long file over the plain, the dry wood wagons already moaning, horses snuffling. A dull thump of hooves and clank of gear and the constant light chink of harness. Save for scattered clumps of buckbrush and prickly pear, and the little patches of twisted grass, the ground was bare. And there were low mountains to the south, and they were bare, too. Westward, the horizon lay flat and true as a spirit level. Those first days, they saw no game, no birds save buzzards. They saw in the distance herds of sheep or goats moving along the skyline in scarves of dust, and they ate the meat of wild asses shot on the plain. The sergeant carried in his saddle scabbard a heavy Wesson rifle that used a false muzzle and paper patch and fired a cone-shaped ball. With it he killed the little wild pigs of the desert, and later when they began to see herds of antelope he would halt in the dusk with the sun off the land, and screwing a bipod into the threaded boss on the underside of the barrel, would kill these animals where they stood grazing at distances of half a mile. The rifle carried a vernier sight on the tang, and he would eye the distance and gauge the wind and set the sight like a man using a micrometer. The second corporal would lie at his elbow with a glass and call the shots high or low should he miss, and the wagon would wait by until he had shot a stand of three or four, and then rumble off across the cooling land with the skinners jostling and grinning in the bed. The sergeant never put the rifle up but what he wiped and greased the bore. They rode well armed, each man with a rifle, and many with a small-bore 5-shot Colt's revolvers. The captain carried a pair of dragoon pistols in scabbards that mounted across the pommel of the saddle so that they rode at each knee. These guns were United States issue, Colt's patent, and he had bought them from a deserter in a Soledad livery stable and paid $80 in gold for them, and the scabbards, and the mold, and flask they came with. The rifle the kid carried had been sawed down and reborded till it weighed very light indeed, and the mold for it was so small he had to patch the balls with buckskin. He had fired it a few times, and it carried much where it chose. It rode before him on the saddle bow, he having no scabbard. It had been carried so before, God's years of it, and the forestock was much worn beneath. In the early dark, the wagon came back with the meat. The skinners had piled the wagon bed with mesquite brush and stumps they'd drug out of the ground with the horses, and they unloaded the firewood and commenced cutting up the gutted antelopes in the floor of the wagon with bowie knives and hand axes, laughing and hacking in a welter of gore, a reeking scene in the light of the handheld lanterns. By full dark, the blackened rib racks leaned steaming at the fires, and there was a jousting over the coals with shaven sticks whereon were skewered gobs of meat and a clank of canteens and endless raillery. And sleep that night on the cold plains of a foreign land, 46 men wrapped in their blankets under the selfsame stars, the prairie wolves so like in their yammering, yet all about so changed and strange. They caught up and set out each day in the dark before the day yet was, and they ate cold meat and biscuit and made no fire. The sun rose on a column already ragged these 6 days out. Among their clothes there was small agreement, and among their hats less. The little painted horses stepped shifty and truculent, and a vicious snarl of flies fought constantly in the bed of the game wagon. The dust the party raised was quickly dispersed and lost in the immensity of that landscape. And there was no dust other, for the pale sutler who pursued them drives unseen, and his lean horse and his lean cart leave no track upon such ground or any ground. By 1,000 fires in the iron-blue dusk he keeps his commissary, and he's a wry and grinning tradesman, good to follow every campaign, or hound men from their holes in just those whited regions where they've gone to hide from God. On this day, 2 men fell sick, and 1 died before dark. In the morning there was another ill to take his place. The 2 of them were laid among sacks of beans and rice and coffee in the supply wagon, with blankets over them to keep them from the sun, and they rode with the slamming and jarring of the wagon, half shearing the meat from their bones, so that they cried out to be left, and then they died. The men turned out in the early morning darkness to dig their graves with the blade bones of antelope, and they covered them with stones and rode on again. They rode on, and the sun in the east flushed pale streaks of light, and then a deeper run of color, like blood seeping up in sudden reaches, flaring plainwise, and where the earth drained up into the sky at the edge of creation, the top of the sun rose out of nothing, like the head of a great red phallus, until it cleared the unseen rim and sat squat and pulsing and malevolent behind them. The shadows of the smallest stones lay like pencil lines across the sand, and the shapes of the men and their mounts advanced elongate before them like strands of the night from which they'd ridden, like tentacles to bind them to the darkness yet to come. They rode with their heads down, faceless under their hats, like an army asleep on the march. By mid-morning another man had died, and they lifted him from the wagon where he'd stained the sacks he'd lain among, and buried him also, and rode on. Now wolves had come to follow them, great pale lobos with yellow eyes that trotted neat of foot, or squatted in the shimmering heat to watch them where they made their noon halt. Moving on again, loping sidling, ambling with their long noses to the ground. In the evening, their eyes shifted and winked out there on the edge of the firelight. And in the morning, when the riders rode out in the cool dark, they could hear the snarling and the pop of their mouths behind them as they sacked the camp for meat scraps. The wagons drew so dry, they slouched from side to side like dogs, and the sand was grinding them away. The wheels shrank, and the spokes reeled in their hubs and clattered like loom shafts. And at night they'd drive full spokes into the mortises and tie them down with strips of green hide. And they'd drive wedges between the iron of the tires and the sun-cracked fellows. They wobbled on. The trace of their untrue labors like sidewinder tracks in the sand. The dual-edge pegs worked loose and dropped behind. Wheels began to break up. 10 days out, with 4 men dead, they started across a plain of pure pumice, where there grew no shrub, no weed, far as the eye could see. The captain called a halt, and he called up the Mexican who served as guide. They talked, and the Mexican gestured, and the captain gestured, and after a while they moved on again. "This looks like the high road to hell to me," said a man from the ranks. "What does he reckon for the horses to eat? I believe they're just supposed to grit up on the sand like chickens and be ready for the shelled corn when it does come." In 2 days they began to come upon bones and cast off apparel. They saw half-buried skeletons of mules with the bones so white and polished they seemed incandescent even in that blazing heat. And they saw panniers and pack saddles and the bones of men. And they saw a mule entire, the dried and blackened carcass hard as iron. They rode on. The white noon saw them through the waste like a ghost army, so pale they were with dust, like shades of figures erased upon a board. The wolves loped paler yet, and grouped and skittered and lifted their lean snouts on the air. At night the horses were fed by hand from sacks of meal and watered from buckets. There was no more sickness. The survivors lay quietly in that cratered void and watched the white-hot stars go rifling down the dark, or slept with their alien hearts beating in the sand like pilgrims exhausted upon the face of the planet Anoreta, clutched to a namelessness wheeling in the night. They moved on, and the iron of the wagon tires grew polished bright as chrome in the pumice. To the south the blue cordilleras stood footed in their paler image on the sand like reflections in a lake, and there were no wolves now. They took to riding by night, silent jornadas, save for the trundling of the wagons and the wheeze of the animals. Under the moonlight, a strange party of elders, with the white dust thick on their mustaches and their eyebrows. They moved on, and the stars jostled and arced across the firmament and died beyond the ink-black mountains. They came to know the night skies well. Western eyes that read more geometric constructions than those names given by the ancients. Tethered to the pole star, they rode the dipper round while Orion rose in the southwest like a great electric kite. The sand lay blue in the moonlight, and the iron tires of the wagons rolled among the shapes of the riders in gleaming hoops that veered and wheeled woundedly and vaguely navigational, like slender astrolabes. And the polished shoes of the horses kept hasping up like a myriad of eyes winking across the desert floor. They watched storms out there so distant they could not be heard, the silent lightning flaring sheetwise, and the thin black spine of the mountain chain fluttering and sucked away again in the dark. They saw wild horses racing on the plain, pounding their shadows down the night, and leaving in the moonlight a vaporous dust like the palest stain of their passing. All night the wind blew, and the fine dust set their teeth on edge. Sand in everything, grit in all they ate. In the morning, a urine-colored sun rose blearily through panes of dust on a dim world and without feature. The animals were failing. They halted and made a dry camp without wood or water, and the wretched ponies huddled and whimpered like dogs. That night they rode through a region electric and wild, where strange shapes of soft blue fire ran over the metal of the horses' trappings, and the wagon wheels rolled in hoops of fire, and little shapes of pale blue light came to perch in the ears of the horses and in the beards of the men. All night sheet lightning quaked sourceless to the west, beyond the midnight thunderheads, making a bluish day of the distant desert. The mountains on the sudden skyline stark and black and livid, like a land of some other order out there, whose true geology was not stone, but fear. The thunder moved up from the southwest, and lightning lit the desert all about them, blue and barren. Great clanging reaches ordered out of the absolute night like some demon kingdom summoned up, or changeling land that come the day would leave them neither trace nor smoke nor ruin more than any troubling dream. They halted in the dark to recruit the animals, and some of the men stowed their arms in the wagons for fear of drawing the lightning, and a man named Hayward prayed for rain. He prayed, "Almighty God, if it ain't too far out of the way of things in your eternal plan, do you reckon we could have a little rain down here?" "Pray it up," some called. And kneeling, he cried out among the thunder and the wind, "Lord, we are dried to jerky down here. Just a few drops for some old boys out here on the prairie and a long ways from home." "Amen," they said. And catching up their mounts, they rode on. Within the hour, the wind cooled, and drops of rain the size of grape shot fell upon them out of that wild darkness. They could smell wet stone and the sweet smell of the wet horses and wet leather. They rode on. They rode through the heat of the day following, with water kegs empty and the horses perishing. And in the evening these elect, shabby and white with dust, like a company of armed and mounted millers wandering in dementia, rode up off the desert through a gap in the low stone hills, and down upon a solitary jacal, crude hut of mud and wattles, and a rudimentary stable and corrals. Bone palings ruled the small and dusty purlieus here, and death seemed the most prevalent feature of the landscape. Strange fences that the sand and wind had scoured, and the sun bleached and cracked like old porcelain, with dry brown weather cracks, and where no life moved. The corrugated forms of the riders passed jingling across the dry bisterland, and across the mud facade of the jacal, the horses trembling, smelling water. The captain raised his hand, and the sergeant spoke, and two men dismounted and advanced upon the hut with rifles. They pushed open a door made of rawhide and entered. In a few minutes they reappeared.
"Somebody's here somewheres. There's hot coals."
The captain surveyed the distance with an air of vigilance. He dismounted, with the patience of one used to dealing with incompetence, and crossed to the jacal. When he came out, he surveyed the terrain again. The horses shifted and clinked and stamped, and the men pulled their jaws down and spoke roughly to them.
"Sergeant?"
"Yes, sir."
"These people can't be far. See if you can find them. And see if there's any forage here for the animals."
"Forage?"
"Forage."
The sergeant placed a hand on the cantle and looked about at the place they were in and shook his head and dismounted. They went through the jacal and into the enclosure behind and out to the stable. There were no animals and nothing but a stall half filled with dry sotals in the way of feed. They walked out the back to a sink among the stones where water stood, and a thin stream flowed away over the sand. There were hoof prints about the tank and dry manure, and some small birds ran mindlessly along the rim of the little creek. The sergeant had been squatting on his heels, and now he rose and spat.
"Well," he said, "is there any direction you can't see 20 miles in?"
The recruits studied the emptiness about.
"I don't believe the folks here has gone that long."
They drank and walked back toward the jacal. Horses were being led along the narrow path. The captain was standing with his thumbs in his belt.
"I can't see where they've got to," said the sergeant. "What's in the shed?"
"Some old dry fodder."
The captain frowned.
"They ought to have a goat or a hog, something, chickens."
In a few minutes, two men came dragging an old man from the stable. He was covered with dust and dry chaff, and he held one arm across his eyes. He was dragged, moaning, to the captain's feet, where he lay prostrate, in what looked like windings of white cotton. He put his hands over his ears and his elbows before his eyes, like one called upon to witness some appalling thing. The captain turned away in disgust. The sergeant towed him with his boot.
"What's wrong with him?" he said. "He's pissing himself, Sergeant. He's pissing himself."
The captain gestured at the man with his gloves.
"Yes, sir. Well, get him the hell out of here." "Do you want Candelario to talk to him? He's a half-wit. Get him away from me."
They dragged the old man away. He had begun to babble, but no one listened. And in the morning he was gone. They bivouacked by the tank, and the farrier saw to the mules and ponies that had thrown shoes, and they worked on the wagons by firelight far into the night. They set forth in a crimson dawn where sky and earth closed in a razorous plain. Out there, dark little archipelagos of cloud and the vast world of sand and scrub shearing upward into the shoreless void where those blue islands trembled and the earth grew uncertain, gravely canted and veering out through tinctures of rose and the dark beyond the dawn to the uttermost rebate of space. They rode through regions of parti-colored stone upthrust in ragged kerfs and shelves of trap rock reared in faults, and anticlines curved back upon themselves and broken off like stumps of great stone tree boles, and stones the lightning had clove open, seeps exploding in steam in some old storm. They rode past trap dikes of brown rock, running down the narrow chines of the ridges and onto the plain like the ruins of old walls, such auguries everywhere of the hand of man before man was, or any living thing. They passed through a village then and now in ruins, and they camped in the walls of a tall mud church and burned the fallen timbers of the roof for their fire, while owls cried from the arches in the dark. The following day, on the skyline to the south, they saw clouds of dust that lay across the earth for miles. They rode on, watching the dust until it began to near, and the captain raised his hand for a halt and took from his saddlebag his old brass cavalry telescope and uncoupled it and swept it slowly over the land. The sergeant sat his horse beside him, and after a while the captain handed him the glass.
"Hell of a herd of something."
"I believe it's horses."
"How far off do you make them?"
"Hard to tell."
"Call Candelario up here."
The sergeant turned and motioned for the Mexican. When he rode up, he handed him the glass, and the Mexican raised it to his eye and squinted. Then he lowered the glass and watched with his naked eyes, and then he raised it and looked again. Then he set his horse with the glass at his chest like a crucifix.
"Well," said the captain.
He shook his head.
"What the hell does that mean? They're not buffalo, are they?"
"No, I think maybe horses."
"Let me have the glass."
The Mexican handed him the telescope, and he glassed the horizon again, and collapsed the tube shut with the heel of his hand, and replaced it in his bag, and raised his hand, and they went on. They were cattle, mules, horses. There were several thousand head, and they were moving quarter-wise toward the company. By late afternoon, riders were visible to the bare eye, a handful of ragged Indians mending the outer flanks of the herd with their nimble ponies. Others in hats, perhaps Mexicans. The sergeant dropped back to where the captain was riding.
"What do you make of that, Captain?"
"I make it a parcel of heathen stock thieves, is what I make it.
What do you?"
"Looks like it to me."
The captain watched through the glass.
"I suppose they've seen us," he said.
"They've seen us.
How many riders do you make it?"
"A dozen, maybe."
The captain tapped the instrument in his gloved hand.
"They don't seem concerned, do they?"
"No, sir, they don't."
The captain smiled grimly.
"We may see a little sport here before the day is out."
The first of the herd began to swing past them in a pall of yellow dust, rangy, slat-ribbed cattle with horns that grew a goggle, and no two alike, and small, thin mules, coal-black, that shouldered one another and reared their mallet-shaped heads above the backs of the others, and then more cattle, and finally the first of the herders riding up the outer side and keeping the stock between themselves and the mounted company. Behind them came a herd of several hundred ponies. The sergeant looked for Candelario. He kept backing along the ranks, but he couldn't find him. He nudged his horse through the column and moved up the far side. The lattermost of the drovers were now coming through the dust, and the captain was gesturing and shouting. The ponies had begun to veer off from the herd, and the drovers were beating their way toward this armed company met with on the plain. Already you could see through the dust on the ponies' hides the painted chevrons, and the hands and rising suns and birds and fish of every device, like the shade of old work through sizing on a canvas. And now, too, you could hear above the pounding of the unshod hooves the piping of the quena, flutes made from human bones. And some among the company had begun to saw back on their mounts, and some to mill in confusion. When up from the off side of those ponies there rose a fabled horde of mounted lancers and archers, bearing shields bedight with bits of broken mirror glass that cast a thousand unpieced suns against the eyes of their enemies. A legion of horribles, hundreds in number, half naked or clad in costumes Attic or Biblical, or wardrobed out of a fevered dream, with the skins of animals and silk finery, and pieces of uniform still tracked with the blood of prior owners, coats of slain dragoons, frogged and braided cavalry jackets, one in a stovepipe hat, and one with an umbrella, and one in white stockings and a blood-stained wedding veil, and some in headgear of crane feathers or rawhide helmets that bore the horns of bull or buffalo, and one in a pigeon-tailed coat worn backwards and otherwise naked, and one in the armor of a Spanish conquistador, the breastplate and pauldrons deeply dented with old blows of mace or saber done in another country by men whose very bones were dust, and many with their braids spliced up with the hair of other beasts until they trailed upon the ground, and their horses' ears and tails worked with bits of brightly colored cloth, and one whose horse's whole head was painted crimson-red, and all the horsemen's faces gaudy and grotesque with daubings like a company of mounted clowns, death-hilarious, all howling in a barbarous tongue, and riding down upon them like a horde from a hell more horrible yet than the brimstone land of Christian reckoning, screeching and yammering and clothed in smoke like those vaporous beings in regions beyond right knowing, where the eye wanders and the lip jerks and drools.
"Oh, my God," said the sergeant. A rattling drove of arrows passed through the company, and men tottered and dropped from their mounts. Horses were rearing and plunging, and the Mongol hordes swung up along their flanks and turned and rode full upon them with lances. The company was now come to a halt, and the first shots were fired, and the gray rifle smoke rolled through the dust as the lancers breached their ranks. The kid's horse sank beneath him with a long pneumatic sigh. He had already fired his rifle, and now he sat on the ground and fumbled with his shot pouch. A man near him sat with an arrow hanging out of his neck. He was bent slightly, as if in prayer. The kid would have reached for the bloody hoop-iron point, but then he saw that the man wore another arrow in his breast,